Welcome to another Picudos. We're happy to have Jamie Sikora here, traveling from the other end of the globe, to talk to us about ground state connectivity of local Hamiltonians.
Thanks, guys. So I'm going to be talking about some recent work I've done with Siva Grubian, who's now at VCU.
What VCU is this?
I'm sorry?
What VCU is
this? Virginia Commonwealth University.
Okay.
Yep. So I'm going to be talking about a recent area called quantum Hamiltonian complexity. It's been getting lots of interest lately. Well, it's been a number of years now. In this area, this is kind of a merging of quantum physics and computational complexity theory. Okay, so the idea or the flavor of these problems is you have some kind of physics flavor problem and you want to kind of analyze it using computer science ideas.
Okay. Which is which?
That depends on your perspective. The physicists are cats, okay. Okay, so here's the outline of my talk. So talking about quantum Hamiltonian complexity and how I view it, and then I'm going to introduce the problem. So kind of a new problem in this area called ground state connectivity. And then maybe some background, depending if we need it, on some quantum complexity theory. So, and this will be needed to state the results. And then I'll focus on a few key ideas in the results, and then I'll wrap up. So Hamiltonian complexity. So we have a key local Hamiltonian. So this is going to be the central concept in this talk. And it's going to be a sum of individual Hamiltonians, and each one is going to act on at most k qubits. So this is what k local means. So this example here, it acts non-trivially on every qubit, but each one only acts non-trivially on two, so it's a two-local Hamiltonian. Okay. And I usually give this talk to computer scientists, so I have this notation explanation here, but I don't think I need to do that here. So yeah, I'll be seeing energy levels or eigenvalues and all that stuff. So we'll be interested in states with low energy. So we'll want this inner product to be small. So the central idea is you're given a Hamiltonian, and you want to know how hard it is to decide some property of it. For example, the common example, you have some local Hamiltonian, and you want to know if there exists a state of low energy. Okay? So this is a very celebrated problem. It received a lot of attention, and we're going to be introducing a new idea today. So the problem is ground state connectivity, and just an informal idea is you have some input, which is a local Hamiltonian, and you're also given two ground states, okay? This initial state and a final state, and they're both ground states or low energy. And you want to decide whether there exists a sequence of local unitaries mapping the final, the initial state to the final state, okay? But you want it through the ground space of H, okay? So there's some kind of condition on this sequence. Of course, if you had no restriction on the unitaries, you could easily just map any state to another state that you want. But here they have to be local, so they'll have some structure. And more importantly, after the application of each unitary, you want the state to also have low energy. Is the setting clear? So this is just the informal definition. I'll get to exactly what we care about, the parameters later, but. Well, so it also depends on the states here. So
if really broadly to get a sense of what you're getting at, you know what I mean?
So
Icing model. Okay, no connectivity, right? Two ground states, all up, all down.
Okay.
Not connected. One with a lot of connectivity, I don't know, because you have multiple qubits. There's some Hamiltonian on some of them, the other ones.
Yeah. So if you have a very large ground space with lots of flexibility, they can easily be connected. But sometimes you have some weird examples too. If you're given something that's entangled and you have a product state and you only allowed single qubit unitaries, then you obviously can't map one to the other. So there's these kind of contrived examples. So I should say at this point, I'm not a physicist at all in any way. So if I say something that rubs you the wrong way, please let me know. Or if you have any ideas. Some of the applications we have came from ideas from physicists in earlier versions of this talk. So I'm always happy to hear these ideas.
So the
motivation that Sev and I had came from the classic version, which I'll talk about later.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So yeah, we started with classical, went quantum, and then worried about the physics later.
Well, it seems like a scenario that ought to have some physical motivation behind it.
Well, here's a couple applications. So something that you might be interested in. Now, suppose you want to create some kind of qubit, and you want to store it in some quantum memory. Now, suppose you have some kind of gapped Hamiltonian. It's degenerate. It could have lots of states. Now, what you don't want to happen, so if it's a gapped Hamiltonian, so if you have a small bit of noise, it's not going to take the state out of the ground space. But if it's degenerate, it could maybe wander around the ground space. So on the assumption that this noise or these errors occur locally, what you could have is this problem, GSCon, for ground state connectivity, could decide whether this is a good way to store your qubit. Okay? You may have some desired thing you want to store and something that's undesired. But if you can connect them through the ground space easily by local unitaries, then this is probably not a good thing you want in quantum memory. Or if you just want to build a quantum computer, you have two states and you want to treat them as 0 and 1. And what you don't want is noise to map 0 to 1 without you doing it. Okay? You want it to stay at 0 and you want 1 to stay at 1. Okay? So this problem helps decide whether it's a good memory or not. And very similarly, if you want to look at stabilizer codes, so if you have a bunch of stabilizers generated by these guys here, a code word is in the common plus 1 eigenspace. Now, if you want, you can think of this as a ground space of a Hamiltonian by defining your Hamiltonian like this, where this guy is going to be the projection on the plus one eigenspace. So now the question whether these two states are connected is the question of whether, if you have two code words, whether you can map one to the other with local errors, but still stay in the code space. Okay, so it's undetectable. Okay, and this is something you don't want in the code. Okay, so there's some kind of physical motivations why you want to care about this problem. So I'm going to state the results on how hard it is to decide whether two states are connected or not.
Sorry, I guess maybe I'm realizing I don't exactly understand the problem. Or are you going to maybe define it more formally?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes. Yeah. So complexity theory. So I wasn't sure. Are people familiar with Merlin Arthur protocols? Yes? Should I skip them or go through them quickly?
I could use a refresher. I mean,
okay.
I understand the vague idea of a checkable proof, I guess.
Okay. So this is Merlin Arthur protocols. The idea is they both get a yes-no question. And Arthur wants to decide whether it's a yes or no, or the answer, I guess. And he's going to get some help from Merlin. Now, Arthur here, he's time efficient, so he's bounded in some way. He cannot just compute yes or no. But he's going to get some help from Merlin. And Merlin is magical. He can come up with any kind of proof or help he wants. It doesn't matter how he comes up with it. The important thing is that Arthur's going to get it and then check it in some kind of efficient way. Okay? And the idea is you want to come up with the protocol in a way that Arthur's usually correct. So that's kind of like the big idea. So here's the example. You're given a polynomial, and you just want to know whether there's a root or not. And Merlin could just give the root to Arthur, and he can compute and check if it is 0. But if you're given a question and the answer is no, it should be the case that every proof Merlin gives, then Arthur's going to reject with high probability. So it doesn't matter what value of x Merlin gives here, it's not going to evaluate to 0. So the main idea is that you're going to get help from Merlin. Now, there's some classical versions of this problem. So Arthur here is going to have some classical computer, and he's going to receive some bit string. And there's different variants. One is MA. MA is whenever Arthur is correct with some bounded probability. So let's say 2/3. NP is whenever he's always correct. But if you switch it from time efficient to space efficient, then you get P space. Okay? So, and this is a much larger class because it doesn't, he can run a very inefficient amount of operations, but his space is bounded. And then there's NEXP, which is roughly, he's not efficient at all. He can just, he has a lot of space and a lot of time, exponential. Okay? So these are some classical versions. Now there's a quantum version. Arthur now is a quantum computer, and he's going to get a quantum proof. He's going to put that in, and he's going to see whether it's the answer to the problem, and it has to be correct to probability 2/3. Okay? So you've probably seen this before. Now he has a little brother, a quantum classical version. So this one, Arthur still has a quantum computer, but the help has to come in a form of classical bits. And in this case, so it's quantum classical because it's half quantum, half classical. And you still has to be bounded probability of being correct. Or of error, I should say. Okay. And this guy here is going to be the one that shows up the most, QCMA. And here's the containment. So the ones that are most interesting in this talk are QCMA down here, P-space up here, and this gap is seemingly very large. So QCMA is pretty hard problems. P-space, you think of it as really hard problems, and NEXP are ridiculously hard problems. Okay? But so this is the range we're looking at. And we're going to be interested in what's called complete problems. Complete problems are, you can think of them as problems that exactly represent the hardness of this class. Okay? And to show they're complete, they have to be in the class, and they have to be able to solve any problem in the class. Okay? So now that we have complete problems, okay, so here's a few examples. So QMA complete problem, they're both given a three local Hamiltonian. And the question is, does this Hamiltonian have a state of low energy? And what Merlin's job is to actually give the state. So he can give the quantum state, because it's QMA. And then Arthur's going to check if it has low energy or not. Okay. And this is complete for QMA, as shown about 12 years ago. Okay. In QCMA, there's a version of that problem that's QCMA complete. And this is, does H have an efficient low energy state? And by efficient, I mean that you have some kind of universal gate set, 1 and 2 qubit unitaries, but the amount of gates that you apply to create it is polynomial. Okay? So in some sense, it's efficient. Before, you could have an exponential number of gates creating the state. So in this case, it's QCMA, because you could just send the classical description of the state, okay? Or some kind of rough approximation. Okay? So this is QCMA complete. Okay, so our results, we'll need a more formal definition. So back to ground state connectivity, GSConn. There's three parameters that are most important. And that is the locality of the Hamiltonian. So now we have K local Hamiltonian. It's going to act on N qubits, so N is kind of a fixed parameter. And we have two ground states of this Hamiltonian. And the initial final state, and they're specified by quantum circuits. So it's some classical description. And the question is, does there exist a sequence of q qubit unitaries, so this is the locality of the unitary, and there's t of them, a little harder to see, but didn't write it there. So you have the number of unitaries is also a parameter. And you want to know if you apply all the unitaries in this sequence, do you map the initial state close to the final state? And after you apply each unitary, are you going to be staying in the ground space? Or some kind of approximation of the ground space. So the energy has to be less than some parameter.
So these unitaries I guess, a discrete object. You're not insisting on a continuous path.
That's right, yeah. We've thought of the continuous version later, maybe I'll mention it, but yeah, these are discrete.
So these unitaries, well, they have to be local. Okay, so I guess there's an efficient description.
Well, it depends.
If you're local for some fixed queue, then you can just write the matrix entries of them.
Yeah.
And I guess if Q is allowed to grow, then you can make a distinction between whether there's an efficient description or not.
Yeah, exactly.
When you say small in quotes there, are we really just restricting our questions to things that are in the exact, eigenspace of the ground state of the Hamiltonian?
So when I say here it's small, there's some parameter, let's say alpha.
I see.
And whenever, so that's the yes answer. Or if it's a no, if there doesn't exist, this is called a promise problem. So you can show that any sequence of unitaries, this is far away from there. Again, some parameter.
Got it.
Or there exists, for any unitary evolution of this form, this inner product is large. So now you have another parameter. So you get to play with the parameters.
Got it.
Can you use arbitrary Q qubit unitaries, or do you have a finite library?
Arbitrary. Yep.
Are we assuming the Hamiltonian is unfrustrated, or not?
Yeah, we're assuming the norm of each term is bounded by one.
Are we assuming that the ground state energy is zero, or it could be anything?
Yeah, it could be anything.
Okay, so when you say that it's small, you mean close to the ground state energy?
Yeah. Any more questions? Okay, so the difficulty of deciding whether it's yes or no depends on K, Q, and T quite a bit. So if K equals 5, you have a 5-local Hamiltonian. You have polynomially many unitaries, and each one is allowed to act on 2 qubits. Then you get a QCMA complete problem. Okay. So this is classical proof of time-efficient Arthur. So what's kind of neat about this problem, about this result, is QCMA complete problems are kind of hard to find. Usually what you do is you start with a QMA complete problem, and you start restricting it and kind of squishing it down to try to make it fit into QCMA. But with our problem, it goes straight to QCMA, which is kind of neat. And furthermore, we don't even know a QMA complete version. We tried to find one for a while, but weren't able to. So we go straight to QCMA, and we have no idea about QMA. The second result, if the locality is 3, but now you're allowed exponentially many unitaries, so many, many, but each one is only allowed to act on a single qubit, then you get p-space complete. So this is the same one, but now it's space-efficient Arthur. And we have a succinct version. I won't go into many details during this talk, but there's a way to make this into a succinct version with the same parameters and get nx complete. Okay. And succinct just means how the Hamiltonian is actually exponentially large, and it's just how you access it. So yeah, it's just another version I just want to mention.
So in some sense, one could think of this succinct version as being easier, because if you were to blow up, you might expect that it was X space. Blow up the previous result.
So if you had succinct local Hamiltonian problem, I would suspect it's QMA X complete.
Yeah.
Where this, it doesn't go up, it goes down to NX.
Right.
But up here, whenever the classical version of this, Yeah, I'll just leave it there.
Could I just to back up to your previous question about whether it's in the ground space? I mean, I guess maybe I'm splitting hairs here, but like if you're just given an alpha and beta, then like anything, any eigenspace whose energy is below alpha is good, right? So I guess you're not actually restricted to just the ground space, unless it happens to be the case that your parameters alpha and beta are chosen such that the only eigenspaces with energy less than alpha is the ground space.
Well, but you're given two states, an input and output state. that are promised to be in the ground space, right? So
yeah, but in between, you can leave the ground space as long as you don't leave an energy.
That's right, as long as the energy stays low.
Yeah, but low doesn't have to be in the ground space. It could be.
Yeah, yeah, but that was already explicit in that.
Okay, okay.
Wasn't it? I mean, because that's what it means to say the energy is
small. Well, so I thought what you said is that you're always
to...
staying in the ground space, and I just kind of realized that you don't have to always stay in the ground space.
But yeah, it's kind of a wiggly definition of ground space.
Anyway, I mean, there is some sort of distinction between cases where you have low-lying eigenstates where you could be orthogonal to the ground state and still have a low energy, versus case where you have like a constant gap or something, in which case having a low energy means that actually you have a high fidelity to the ground space. But
no.
I don't know. As a definition, it seems fine.
So the Q equals one case is one where you're only operating on each individual qubit by itself.
That's right.
So this is like some sort of, it's like, are you asking then basically, is the ground space kind of connected under local operations only, right? Not even classical communication, I guess. Is the ground space like some sort of entanglement?
Yeah, it's very locally. In fact, whenever we come up with why it's B-space complete, we'll be acting on product states as well. So it's not very, very quantum.
So have you considered this problem where Q is allowed to grow?
Yep. So as long as Q is constant, we still get Q semi-complete. If Q equals 2 here, we can't put in P space anymore. And I'm not sure about this one. I'd have to think about it.
Like I said earlier, if you allow Q to grow, then you can make a distinction between unitaries that are efficiently implementable, or at least efficiently describable, versus just arbitrary unitaries. Because you can imagine, if Q is allowed to grow, then you could ask that your unitaries have to be given by an efficient circuit.
Yeah.
And if you make that restriction, then you probably still get QCMA, because
yes.
the prover can just send the
yes.
description on the circuits. But
yeah,
if you don't make that description, then the prover has to.
Yeah. Any more questions? But I have to think about these. Or... Okay, so I'll talk about some of the proof ideas. So the containment proofs mostly all follow the same idea. They're both given the instance of GSCon, and the idea is that you're going to send some classical description unitaries. Okay. And there's some little techniques to make it work, some fiddling around, but it's mostly straightforward. So you have unitaries which have constant size, and you're just going to discretize over this continuous space and send the description. Okay. And you discretize enough such that basically whenever Arthur puts together the description, puts together the states, and does his testing, he's going to be correct with high probability. And the length of the classical description will depend on whether it's P space or QCMA or NX. But the sizes do align. So the idea of the containment is pretty straightforward. What's more interesting is the hardness proofs. So you have, we'll first show QCMA. So any QCMA problem can be solved by this instance of GSCon. Okay, here's the idea. First, we're going to take a QCMA complete local Hamiltonian problem, and we're going to model it as an instance of GSCon. And then there's two things to check. One is if the Hamiltonian has a low energy state, then the GSCon must have the two states connected. And alternatively, if there's no low energy state, then the two ground states have to be disconnected. Okay. And then if these two properties hold, deciding, yes and no in this GSCon will decide the high and low energy of the Hamiltonian, and therefore solve any problem QCMA. Okay, so here's the construction. You start with this Hamiltonian here for the QCMA complete problem, and it's three local. And what we're going to do next is tack on this extra system here, which we call Go qubits, and you'll see why we call that in a sec. And all it is going to be a projection. Okay, it's going to project onto anything that's 0, 0, 0, or 1, 1, 1. or not that. Yeah. So now we have a five local. So this projection can be written in a two local way. So now we have five local. And now we need the initial ground states. So we have, let's see. So we have this kind of clean slate for this right here. But this initial state here is going to be zeros here. And that's going to be in the null space of P. And right here, we're going to have all ones over here. So we can think of this as a blank slate and the two things that are in the null space of P. Okay. So these things have zero energy. So why does this work? We want to know whether these two guys are connected through this ground space. Well, we can start with the easier one. Suppose that this guy right here does have low energy ground space, or ground state. And then what you can do is you can apply the polynomially many unitaries here and create it. Okay? And since it's QCMA, go in the polynomially many. Okay? And once you're done there, what you do is you start flipping those zeros to ones in the second register. Okay? So these zeros here, you map this 0 to a 1, this 0 to a 1, and this 0 to a 1. Note when you do that, you're stepping out of this ground space. Okay, now you have energy 1. But over here, since you have low energy, you still have low energy overall. Okay? What you want to avoid is whenever both of these guys have high energy. Okay? And then, after that, you're safe again because you've mapped up these zeros to all 1s right here. So now you're in a space of zero energy here. So now you're allowed to do whatever you want in this system. And you uncompute it, and you're back at zero. Okay? So this works, you're playing this balancing act. You have this product Hamiltonian, and you want at least one of the energies to be small. Okay? So here's a quick picture of what's going on. So you have two registers. You just apply the polymany unitaries. And then this guy here, when you start applying them, it's initiating a check to see the energy on the system. And then you just uncompute and you're back to zero. Yeah. So what's more interesting is that whenever there's a case when there's no, when all of the eigenvalues of this guy are large. Now, if that's large, imagine doing the same protocol. Right here, you apply some polymany unitaries, but down here, whenever you start applying these X operators, you're going to step out of the ground space over here and have a large energy up here. So now, whenever you're checking the energy over here, all the energies up here are very high or above some threshold. So now, when you multiply them together, you have high energy. Okay? So it's game over. So that's the rough idea, but the thing is, you're allowed to apply two qubit unitaries. So right here, we have three qubits. So there's not really any way to get around stepping out of the ground space here. And to see that, we're going to have something called the traversal lemma, which says that basically you have to step out of the ground space here. You have to have some large energy on the system. Is the construction clear or is kind of?
Yeah. So it sounds like the hard part is just showing that no sequence of two qubit unitaries can keep you in the ground space.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. So to show such a thing, we have the traversal lemma, which is basically saying if we map these three things, three zeros to three ones using two qubit unitaries, we have some kind of large energy on that system. Okay. So here's a traversal lemma. So we need a notion of k-orthogonality. So we say two states are k-orthogonal. If you can apply a unitary to one, any k-qubit unitary to one, and it's still orthogonal. So this is kind of like saying it's really orthogonal. Okay. So k-orthogonal plus orthogonal, said the unitary distribution identity. But orthogonal doesn't always imply k-orthogonal. If you have these two strings here, they're orthogonal, but they're not even one orthogonal because you can map that 0 to a 1. Okay. So they're not that really orthogonal. But 0, 0, 0, and 1, 1, 1 are two orthogonal. It doesn't matter what two qubits you choose, it's still going to be orthogonal. Okay? And that's what we need. So here's a simplified version of the traversal lemma. So you have two k-orthogonal states, and you want to map one to the other using k-qubit unitaries. What you can show is that there exists an I such that, so if you look at the evolution under these unitaries, there exists an I such that you have some large energy on the subspace that's spanned by the complement of B and W. So it has to, at some point, step out of the ground space, which, when you think about it, it seems kind of obvious. But it's a little tricky to prove. And to prove this, we borrow ideas from the quantum Zeno effect. Okay. So this is my very rough interpretation of what the Zeno effect is. So right here, let's suppose you ground your child. Okay. But if you don't want your child closely enough, he's going to escape out the window to freedom. Okay. But if you're constantly observing your child, you're constantly looking to make sure she's on the chair, then she's not going to be able to get far enough to escape out the window. Okay. So you constantly watch your child, it's going to stay in the state you want. Okay. Here's the quantum version. So you have some nerd here who's really fascinated by electrons. He's going to keep staring at them, and he wants to see the state of an electron. Okay. And if he keeps observing and keeps projecting a lot, or continuously, or however you want to think of it, it's going to stay in some kind of the state you want. Okay. So this is the idea that we're going to apply in the proof. So if you keep observing it enough, it's going to stay in some state. Okay. So here's the lemma again. We want to prove it jumps out of the subspace. Now, classically, if you think about this, what's going to happen? So you want to see, you're at 0, 0, 0, and you want to get to 1, 1, 1. Okay? This is the particular case in the proof. But if classically, you kind of have to walk along the edges. You can only apply bit flips. And you see, once you go this way, you're obviously out of the span. You're at 0, 0, 1 now. So you're obviously really far away from the span of 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 1. Okay? So if you want to classically just flip bits, there's no way to stay to be at one of those two states. But maybe quantumly you can do it. There's some kind of weird path evolution can take. Like maybe it's somehow sneaky and goes up the middle. Okay? So we're going to assume for a contradiction that such a path exists. So in quantum, you can kind of do this little sneaky thing. So to derive a contradiction, consider the same evolution. So some sequence of unitaries. But after you apply each unitary, we're going to project onto this subspace. 0, 0, 0 plus 1, 1, 1. Okay. So you apply the first unitary, you project, second unitary, project, and so on. So if you look at both of these two sequences, you can derive a contradiction. The quantum Zeno effect is going to say that right here, what you're doing, you're applying a two local unitary. And then you're going to project onto this subspace, but these guys are two orthogonal. So right here, after you project, it's going, with some probability, it's going to end up at 0, 0, 0. But with zero probability, it's going to end up at 1, 1, 1, because it has zero overlap with that subspace. Okay? Then you apply the second unitary. And you project again. And then since you really started at 0, 0, 0, you're going to collapse back down to 0, 0, 0. So every term here, every point, is still actually collapsing down to 0, 0, 0. Okay? So this is kind of inspired by the quantum Zeno effect. You're kind of continuously observing it, and it's staying in the state you want at 0, 0, 0. But we assume that it had large over inner product with a subspace 0, 0, 0 and 1, 1, 1. So really what we're doing, this measurement is a gentle measurement. Okay? So the gentle measurement says if it has large overlap, then the state and the post-measured state are very close together still. Okay? So, and since this state here and the measured state are close together, the final points actually have to be quite close together. But this is a contradiction, because the Zeno effect idea is saying that this guy's ending at 1 and this guy's staying at 0, and gentle measurement saying that they're ending at the same spot. Yeah. So you get a contradiction. So at some point in the sequence, you have to step out of the ground space. So this is almost what we need. The thing was that we only proved it on this system, but we're allowed to apply 2 qubit gates. So we could do something sneaky and maybe apply a unitary that acts on one of these qubits and one of these qubits, some larger thing. So we need a little more fuller version. And to do that, we need k-orthogonal subspaces. So this is going to generalize the idea of k-orthogonal states. Now we say 2 subspaces are k-orthogonal. If you take any vector in one and any vector in the other, if they remain k-orthogonal. Okay. So here's an example that helps us with our construction. If you look at the +1 eigenspace of this operator and the +1 eigenspace of this operator, these guys are going to be 2 orthogonal subspaces. You can think of this as you've measured and you've gotten 0, 0, 0 in the last 3 qubits, and this one is 1, 1, 1 in the last 3 qubits. So you can see that these are 2 orthogonal, and here's the full one. You have 2 subspaces. So roughly, it's the same as before, except now you can be within epsilon of the final state. And these states now can actually live on a larger space. So it's just not living on those 3 qubits here. Where'd that picture go? So now the states don't just have to be here. They can be within the whole thing. Okay. But there's some restriction the way we use it on how they behave on just part of the state. So the full traversal lemma is basically proving soundness for the hardness case. Are there any questions so far? Okay, so I should have time to go through the p-space problem. So this construction is slightly different, so I thought I'd talk about that too. And now we have that the locality of the Hamiltonian is 3, exponential number of unitaries, and single qubit unitaries. So I'll just go over this quickly. So we have a 3 CNF formula of this form. So any 3 CNF formula. Now, if you're given one, and you're given 2 satisfying assignments to that problem, and you want to know, does there exist a sequence of strings such that it starts at x, it ends at y, and the Hamming distance between each one is at most 1. So you're allowed to flip 1 bit at a time. So you start at x, you flip a bit, you flip a bit, you flip a bit, and you have to end up at y. But the condition is that at each point, you have to be in a satisfying assignment. So it's in some sense, this is the classical version of ground state connectivity. And this is the classical version, whether 2 assignments are connected. Okay. And it was proven somewhat recently that this is p-space complete. Okay. So what we're going to do is use our ground state connectivity to prove, to model this problem. So there's kind of a canonical way of embedding formulas into Hamiltonians. What you do, you take the ith clause, you look at the one assignment to these 3 variables that would make that evaluate to false. Okay. And then you define the ith term in the Hamiltonian to be projecting onto that space. Okay. So with this construction, this local term here has energy zero if and only if the ith clause is satisfied. Okay. And whenever you look at the sum, this energy here is zero. Let's see, the energy is zero of the whole thing if and only if x is satisfying assignment to the clause. So this is a way to take the classical idea and embed it in the quantum world. Okay. So that's how we go from formulas to Hamiltonians. And we're going to go from strings to states in a very easy way. You just stick brackets around them. Okay? The most easiest thing you could think of. So now we have the quantum state, which is this basis state x and the basis state y. Okay? And that's our instance. So now we want to see if x and y are connected through this formula, we want them to be connected through the ground space of H. Well, the ground space of H is basically spanned by solutions. Like if you look at the basis states, they're just solutions to the assignment. So this one's quite easy to see. So you start at x, you end up at y. This is satisfying, this is satisfying, this is satisfying. All you have to do is apply NOT gates to x, and you'll stay as a basis state, and you'll end up at y. Okay? And you'll always be satisfying, or low energy in this case. So what's more interesting is showing the disconnected case. Because up here, you could just use NOT gates, and everything's more or less classical. But down here, you can kind of cheat. You can do something on a continuous level. So x and y are disconnected. There's not a sequence. You always step out of the satisfying space. Now we want to show that they're disconnected through the ground space of H. Okay. And to do that, we can use the traversal lemma again. Okay. Now, to do that, we're going to partition the set of satisfying assignments. We're going to let Rx be the ones that are reachable from x. So if you can flip a bit and have it still satisfying, then it's going to be sucked into this set Rx. Okay. So you start at x, and then you flip a bit. And you look at, and then you take that set, and then you see if you can flip a bit from there and still be satisfying. Okay. So it's kind of going to branch out in some way. And if you look at this, you define s to be the span of these states, and T to be the span of all the rest of the satisfying ones. Okay? And I claim this is enough for the traversal lemma. Well, we're starting at X, and X is obviously reachable from X, so it's in this subspace S. And we're ending at Y, and Y is satisfying, but by assumption, you can't reach it from X. So it's not in the set, so it has to be in the set, which is a partition. So x, ket x is in here, and ket y is in here. And these two states are one orthogonal. There's no way to get from any state here to any state here by applying a one local unitary. If we could, then that state here would have been sucked into this definition up here. So they're one orthogonal, and we're applying one local unitaries. So therefore, the traversal lemma says that if you have a sequence that goes from x to y, then there has to be some point in the evolution that steps out of the ground space. And the ground space of y is basically everything that's not everything that's not in these two subspaces, the orthogonal complement. So the traversal lemma is actually kind of robust. It also works in this case, not just the one with the Go registers and this kind of construction. Okay, and there's also the NX proof, but it's basically throwing ideas, these two proofs, and kind of mushing them together. You take ideas from both. It doesn't introduce any new ideas, but you still have Go registers, like in the GSConf proof, but you also have formulas embedded into Hamiltonians from the p-space one. So it's kind of like mixing the ideas. Okay, I guess I can wrap up. So to recap, understanding ground spaces, local Hamiltonians is important. Okay? You want to understand the quantum system. You want to understand its ground spaces. We defined a notion of ground state connectivity for local Hamiltonians, and we showed various hardness results that depend much on the parameters. So the question, the open question, which you ask us, what happens if you have exponentially two qubit unitaries? This is something we asked ourselves for a while, and it's QMA hard, but beyond that, we have no idea. So our containment in p-space doesn't work anymore, so this is quite open-ended. I believe it's NX complete, but I'm not sure. And something that's kind of interesting from a computer science point of view and a physics point of view, what happens if you don't have any general Hamiltonian, but you have a Hamiltonian of a special form? Okay, so physicists might care about some specific Hamiltonian that models some particular system. How hard is the problem then? And in classical, people have looked at dichotomies for this as well. Like if you have some formula that has some kind of special, the clauses have some special forms, then the problem could become easier. Yeah, and that's it. Thanks.